From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on February 29th, 2020, in the state of South Carolina. Voters participated in Democrats' fourth nominating contest in the presidential primaries, and coming into South Carolina, Senator Bernie Sanders was on fire. He had picked up significant victories, and he led in many polls across the country. But when other contenders started dropping out of the race, their supporters largely coalesced around one candidate, former Vice President Joe Biden. Biden won big in South Carolina. It was the launching pad for his presidential run. Progressive Democrats were crestfallen at the time, feeling that once again the Democratic establishment had blocked the ascendance of both Sanders and a new progressive era. With Biden, they expected milquetoast politics and predictable political centrism. Were they wrong? So far, progressive writer Anand Giridharadas says yes. Writing for The Atlantic, Giridharadas argues that Biden has put forward the most progressive set of policies in several generations, and he has transformed his own political identity. Anand says Biden is simply reacting to the political and social forces of the moment, writing, quote, "Biden is who he has always been, and if people are observing a change, it is because the terrain below him has shifted. That might be enough," end quote. All of which brings up interesting questions about how political movements make change. One idea is that they elect new leaders who will bring unmistakable energy and ideas, Bernie Sanders, for example. Another idea is that they exert pressure on elected leaders and move them one way or another. Joe Biden, yes, but also Andrew Cuomo, state leaders, leaders in state houses across the country. In New York State, the Working Families Party has long chosen this path, worked to move Democrats to the left, not by supporting a different political party or usually not by running their own candidates per se, but, for example, by playing within the confines, largely within party structures. And last year, the Working Families Party endorsed a list of Democratic candidates who not only won their primary elections, they defeated Democratic opponents who had been supported by the entrenched political establishment. Sarah Clark defeated Justin Wilcox. Damon Meeks defeated Ernest Flagler Mitchell. Harry Bronson defeated Alex Udelson. And now the WFP has endorsed a slate of candidates for Rochester City Council. They're supporting Malik Evans over Lovely Warren in the mayoral election. The question is, will the WFP candidates and the leaders follow through with their progressive policies if they're elected? Next week, we will examine what the conservative movement is facing. Senator Lindsey Graham said this week that Republicans like Liz Cheney are arguing that the GOP cannot move forward with Donald Trump, but Graham says that Republicans cannot move forward without him. That's a conversation for a different day. Today is about how the left is shaping up and what forces are moving it and inspiring it. Our guests this hour include the director of the New York Working Families Party, Xochi Nemeca, is back with us. Welcome. Thanks for being with us, Xochi.
Hey, good afternoon, Evan. So good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Stevie Vargas is an education organizer and chair of the Rochester chapter of the WFP. Stevie, welcome back to the program.
Thank you again for having me, Evan. Always a pleasure.
And Emily is WFP chapter member. Emma, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
So I want to just start with sort of a broad-based question, and then we'll get sort of more granular as we look at New York State politics and all the things that are sort of happening right now. But when you think about how change happens, you know, in our own community, we've seen elections. You know, Xochi, we've seen Green Party candidates run. We see that again this year. They do not want to run as Democrats. They don't believe they are Democrats. We see Democratic Socialist candidates sometimes running under their own banner, sometimes running as Democrats. And we see that at the national level. So, you know, there's this sort of interesting moment where the political left is pretty diverse. There's a lot of layers to it. It almost looks more like European politics as a whole. And I'm curious to know what you think the most effective path to getting change accomplished is, whether it's electing candidates who are clearly devoted to that change, even if them winning elections is maybe harder. Or is it, you know, saying, hey, whoever is elected, we're going to move you, we're going to push you, and we're going to exert pressure on you. What do you think, Xochi?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think that it's cyclical and it's a layered strategy, right? So what we've seen in the past couple of years is that progressive insurgents are winning and scoring impressive victories. Some of those victories were clearly reaction to Trump, right? The passions he ignited and frustrations that we felt towards the establishment Democrats that used strategies that failed to beat him the first time. Some of those victories were new energy that felt you know, the result of possibility and the inspiration of candidates like AOC and Rashida Tlaib here in New York, Tiffany Caban, Jessica Ramos, where left leaders, progressives, people of color, young people, women in particular, were jumping into electoral politics. And that is what we've been seeing, is this cycle of movement energy on the ground, from the climate movement to the movement of the Dreamers to the movement for Black Lives and the uprising, being translated into electoral energy to elect candidates who are running on a clear platform connected to movement, and then take that energy into a governing agenda. And so people are seeing the possibility of connecting movement to elections to actually governing as progressives, which for too long they've been separated. Electoralism was not a strategy the left wanted to use. And so we think that for real change to happen, we have to be investing in that cycle and ensure that movement is feeding the energy, bringing people into the ballot box. And then the ballot box serves as a referendum and a mandate for what kind of governance New Yorkers want and expect, and the pressure keeps happening once our leaders are in office. And so people are responding and reacting to this new surge of energy, and even those who did not come out of movement are forced to either run towards the moment to meet it, or making weird appeasements, you know, to business interests and seeing themselves being irrelevant and sidelined. And so that energy is catalyzing a whole new generation and a whole new type of leadership that will deliver more progressive victories. And people on the ground are seeing the difference in their lives.
Well, we're going to spend a big section of this conversation on state politics, and understandably so. I am curious to know, Xochitl, if, you know, 4 or 5 months into this presidential administration, if you view it the way Anand Giridharadas does, which is that it is at least in substance more progressive than a lot of Democrats and a lot of progressives expected it would be at this point. What do you think?
Absolutely. And I think the question of terrain that Anand brings up is so right, right? There is a candidate can be a vehicle, right? Or we can think of elections and campaigns as being a battle of ideas. This primary last year with Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders putting out a real structural framework, right, about how do we think about deep structural reform, influenced the entire campaign. COVID had a deeply clarifying effect for all voters, that our healthcare system was failing us. 2 million of New Yorkers lost their jobs. We saw food lines wrapping around city blocks. Voters were not looking for piecemeal, reformist, democratic tweaks. They're looking for system change. And we, as progressives, the Working Families Party, had been talking about the deep, this framework of crisis, right? This ideological stance that only became more applicable in this moment. And so while we were thrown off and emotionally gutted by COVID-19, our politics were prepared to deal with crisis and the scale of the solutions it demanded. And so Biden is responding to that moment, and I think really stretching to meet the moment by talking about scale, by talking about getting to root causes. And that is because of the groundwork that progressives have laid out. So even if we are not in the White House, our ideas are permeating and driving that agenda. And we're still pushing and fighting consistently to ensure that they deliver fully on the kind of real deep recovery that we know that we need.
Stevie Vargas, how do you see the first 4 or 5 months of this new presidential administration? Is it more progressive than you expected it would be?
Yeah, it is more progressive. Is it as progressive as I want it to be? Absolutely not. But it is a breath of fresh air after the last 4 years under Trump. It is more progressive than what we have seen in the past. And he is undoing a lot of the harm that was done under the previous administration. And that's going to take a lot of work. So I am seeing a lot more. I'm seeing him be a lot more progressive than I expected him to be. But is it enough? I think we can get there, and I think we are up to the task of pushing further to make sure that this government and the institutions are working for everyone.
How do you see it, Emma?
Yeah, I guess I can kind of echo what Stevie was saying. I feel like we still have a long way to go.
It's certainly better than what we've been seeing, and I am hopeful for the future moving forward.
Well, and so, listeners, this hour, if you've got thoughts on where, I don't want to just say the Democratic Party. I mean, this is really more about where progressivism is going and what is getting done, what is being prioritized, largely at the state level, but really in sort of in the American sphere right now. If you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. I'm going to steal one phone call now, and then we're going to kind of dive into what WFP is working on the state level. This is Jane in Rochester. Go ahead, Jane.
Yeah, I am registered as a Democrat so that I can vote in the Democratic primary, but I really am not happy with, for example, the local Democratic committee and a lot of the challenges that it has not dealt with in ways I've wanted them to deal with. And then I'm not happy with either of the parties. I am very progressive, but I'm not a way out there progressive. So what I do is when a candidate is listed as both a Democrat and on the Working Families Party, I often will vote for them on the Working Families line. And I really appreciate the Working Families Party movement towards what I think is just a really solid progressive view on things. I think they play a really important role, and I really want to see them continue. So thank you very much.
Can I ask you a question, Jane?
Yeah, yeah.
Where are you disappointed specifically with local Democrats?
Oh, my God, the racial issues that go back 30 or 40 years, and, you know, it's been tit for tat, blacks and whites, and then the Latinos get caught in the middle. I think some very strong candidates that have not been endorsed by the party. Personally, I'm a Leak supporter all the way, and I'm thrilled he's on the Working Families Party. There's just been especially the racial divide, but I'm forgetting the details, but I know in the not too distant past there were some people that were really kind of blocked from being candidates because of the political machine, who I thought were better candidates. So that's been a lot, but there's a really nasty racial history that goes way, way back and has created some of the divides we have now, and I'm not going to go into the details.
I appreciate the phone call, Jane. Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts. Stevie Vargas, as chair of the Rochester chapter of WFP, when you hear that local voters are choosing to not only vote in a certain way but vote on the WFP line, what's the impact of that? How important is that to you?
That's extremely important. It sends a message to the establishment at the end of the day that the Democratic Party has not done enough work to reach out to the constituents in Rochester, and we can see that at the ballot. And elections and voting, it's a tool, and it's the way that we express our language, our values. And people are continuously voting on our line because they align with our values, our principles, and what we want to see our communities look like at the end of the day. It's an incredibly powerful thing to do. It also signals to the candidates what their constituents want to see and what they want them as electeds to prioritize in office. And that is extremely important.
Listeners, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994 to join the conversation. And before we kind of work through where exactly the priorities are, I want to read one other sort of interesting thing that I was reading this week about the peculiar Americanness of what we think about when it comes to compromise and bipartisanship. Ezra Klein was writing in the New York Times about this, and he was just musing about both President Biden and often the American electorate and often the American journalistic establishment as raising compromise and bipartisanship as the highest sort of political standard. Klein wrote the following. He wrote, quote, "I don't think people realize how weirdly American the obsession with bipartisan legislating is. The whole debate is peculiarly American. In parliamentary systems, the job of the majority party or majority coalition is to govern, and the job of the opposition party is to oppose. Cooperation can and does occur, but there's nothing unusual or even regrettable when it doesn't. And government does not grind to a halt in the absence of cooperation. Not so in America, where the president can be from one party and Congress can be controlled by another. In raising bipartisanship to a high political ideal, we have made a virtue out of a necessity, but that's left us little recourse, either philosophically or legislatively, when polarization turns bipartisanship into a rarity. And that's where we are now," end quote. It's an interesting piece of context, and it's not one that I think about very often, but it is factually true that when you have a system in which you can elect a president from one party and elect the majority in the legislating bodies from the other party or other parties, then you're going to have sort of not only opposition, but also this longstanding American trend of praising bipartisanship. Whereas in other countries, you elect the party into power, they select the leader, they govern. And that's not a surprise, and that's not, you know, sort of really even much to even talk about. So I wonder if that's made things more difficult, not necessarily for the Working Families Party, Sochi, but for kind of an American electorate and American media and even some political leaders, probably the president himself, who has long talked about the need for bipartisanship and the need for working across the aisle and the desire to see votes from all quarters on pieces of legislation. Does that complicate what should be the goals of policymaking and legislating in your mind, Sochi?
Yeah, I do. I think so. And I'm thinking back to a quote that, Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez had sometime last year, which is that if we were in another country, Joe Biden and I would not be in the same political party. Mm-hmm. Right. And that is true. Our politics are mostly oppositional, right? People are asked to choose one of two imperfect vehicles. You're a Democrat or a Republican. And what happens is that the parties, especially the Democratic Party, gets diluted and the values, this big tent of values, isn't really clear, right? We as working families leaders and we as progressives, we want and we deserve a party in which our values are not disconnected from a plan to win. And for so many in the Democratic Party, a platform of supporting working people and championing racial equality and universal health care is entirely disconnected from their path to win, right? A path to win that relies on corporate donations, on tailoring their campaign message to moderates, on protecting white wealthy supporters' private interests. And then it's no surprise that in governing, the agenda is then corrupted by the influence of those who helped get them into power. And we believe that we cannot have an agenda or a party in which there is daylight between our values and our path to win. Like, have to be one and the same. And when we start centering bipartisanship, the values start not being essential anymore, right? Compromise and outcome is what is essential. But that doesn't serve anyone. It doesn't serve members of the party. It does not serve working people who need to feel the difference in their lives when Democrats are in power. What we're seeing now under a Joe Biden administration, like we saw in some, there have been a few cases of progressive Democratic leadership in the history of this country, is that working people will be able to look out their window or look at their bank account or look at their schools and see the difference that politics produces. And that is what we need to push forward, that we have to deliver material gains for Americans, and for those who live right with in this country, and demonstrate that our politics can deliver better outcomes for people, can deliver a new world for people. If not, then politics is purely a sport, and the game is about tossing the ball back and forth, and having this agreement with an opposition party, right, Republicans, who fundamentally do not believe in the same world and values that we do, right? That is not actually a recipe for progress.
Yeah, and let me ask Emma a little bit more about this. One thing I think will not happen is something that one of our progressive listeners tweeted at us yesterday, which is that they believe that the Republican Party is headed for some sort of immolation and that we're going to be one party rule in this country. First of all, that ignores the many, many red states. They're not often they're smaller states, but there are, you know, very solidly rural red areas in this country that I don't think are going blue anytime soon. But even if they did, let's sort of honor the premise here. I think what inevitably happens is, to Sochi's point and to Ocasio-Cortez's point, is you're not going to end up with one Democratic Party. It's going to end up looking much more like it does in parts of Europe, where you have sort of Joe Biden would probably be viewed as, you know, somewhat moderate, you know, sort of center right. And there may be a splintering to come in that way. I think sometimes we sort of elide the differences among the left to the detriment of actual beneficial political discourse and just public discourse. The left is not this monolith. People say that about NPR. Oh, you're to the left. I mean, it's just the silliest thing I've ever heard, and I'm sure the Working Families Party feels that way too. But Emma, do you have any sense that this could ever be sort of a one party rule, and it would be just Democrats? Does that make sense to you?
No, I agree with you completely there. I don't think that this would ever be a one-party rule monolith, you know, as you were saying, country, because progress looks different to everyone, and we all are drawn to different things and champion different ways of life or causes. So what's important to one person may be very different from what's important to another. I would love to see a country that provides basic human rights to its citizens. You know, I was talking with a group of children actually 2 days ago, and they understood it completely. They said everyone deserves a home, everyone deserves food, everyone deserves water, everyone deserves health care. They even said medicines that weren't addictive, which I thought was very insightful for an 11-year-old.
Wow.
So it seems amazing that this is such a given for children, and yet it's kind of hard to get adults all on that same page. But I think beyond that, progress can look really different. Well, but even within that, we're seeing that progress looks different to people.
Mm-hmm.
But there's some people who are really drawn to the arts. There's some people who are really drawn to sciences. I don't think we would ever just see a bland kind of one, you know. I think our country, no matter what, is going to be very diverse. It would just be nice if everyone was taken care of in that process.
Well, and on the subject of what Emma's talking about, what the WFP wants to accomplish, let me take a phone call on the subject of some of these priorities, and we're going to get into it with leadership from the WFP. Yardena in Penfield. Go ahead, Yardena.
Yes. So my name is Yardena Shapir, and I own properties, majority of them in the city. I have about 19 units total. Small landlord, and I always was a Democrat. I'm still the Democrat. I voted for the working family last time. And I want to say, as a landlord, I have only one issue, which I spoke about with other landlords that have it now. Since the pandemic, the court put moratorium on eviction. Generally, when I had issue to evict a tenant, I always did it by myself, and I went with the tenant, and we always came to some agreement until we didn't have an agreement. But that's what is the court for. So to me, putting moratorium without asking question and so what happened now, it's the Democrat in the legislature changed to have a majority Democrat, which I applaud. I like it, but I didn't realize that it could hurt small business like mine and others. And I know some friend of mine that they know that their tenant are in good shape. They just know that it's on moratorium. They take advantage. A lot of them don't have a good credit, so they have nothing to lose by not paying.
Why don't you stay there for a second, Yardena? And I'm going to start with Sochi here, because on the subject of policy, this gets right to one of the current debates, even on the left. Go ahead, Sochi. What do you think?
What do I think?
I'm asking Sochi Nemeca, who's director of the New York Working Families Party. Go ahead, Sochi.
Oh. Yeah, thank you for the question. You know, we advocated fully, and we still do, for eviction moratorium, because too many of our neighbors were facing tremendous financial hardship and unable to pay rent through the greatest global crisis, right, of our generation. We still believe that we need to ensure that the government the government addresses the hardship that working people face. In this moment, and I think we saw a case last year, right, when I remember very starkly Demond Meeks going out in the middle of the night, in the middle of winter, to protect a family, a single mother and children, from being evicted from their home. This is a crisis that we can't actually let happen in the wealthiest country in the world, in one of the wealthiest states in our nation, to have our neighbors be thrown out in this moment. And so I do think that the eviction moratorium does provide some relief for landlords who are in specific situations, but ultimately the housing crisis that we have is something we have to address, especially given the year that New Yorkers just had.
Okay. Let me ask Stevie Vargas to weigh in as well. Go ahead, Stevie.
Sorry, I was on mute. Yeah, I'm all for the moratorium. This has been an incredibly difficult year for everyone, and we have experienced a housing crisis unlike any other. And so this moratorium wasn't just about keeping people in their homes, which is incredibly important. It was also a healthcare issue. With this pandemic and people's health at risk, we could not live in a society that put people out on the streets that would exacerbate this COVID pandemic way more and put so many people at risk. We've seen so many deaths. So this is something that we had to do as a society. It was a moral issue as well. I fully believe that housing is a human right, and it's not a business. And this was about taking care of our neighbors. And this moratorium, just like Soshi said, it did provide some relief for landlords as well in specific situations. But this was about keeping people in their homes and keeping the rest of society safe, because we were experiencing an extreme pandemic that took so many lives, and forcing people out into the streets would have made those COVID deaths go up way more.
Emma, anything you want to add?
I would like to...
Hold on, Dana. Okay. I know you're probably going to want to respond, but go ahead, Emma.
Yes.
Oh, I was just going to say, to what Stevie was saying, that it's not necessarily anti-landlord. It's really anti-eviction, having... I was there that night. I watched that eviction that was mentioned with the mother and the three children being torn away from their home a week before Christmas. That shouldn't happen. We need to design a system where people are housed and we're taking care of our neighbors, whether they're tenants, even landlords. I don't think it's necessarily an anti-landlord. It's more of a pro-housing.
Yardena, go ahead if you want to follow.
Yes,
up.
No. I definitely agree with all of this, but one of the reasons to go to court, and I'm understanding all of this, then there is a real issue. I'm just talking about the fact that automatically some tenants don't have an issue. They just take advantage because, like I said, for many different reasons. But normally the courts ask questions, and I always have opportunity to speak with their side, not in front of the judge, outside of the – we talk to the legal aid that help them. Actually, legal aid help us a lot to solve problems. But I've never been in a situation that I have to choose between losing the house or not paying the mortgage or not paying the municipality, my taxes. I always paid everything. So there is a limit to how much landlord can absorb the a year, 2 years, how long they can keep the building and now it's time to start mowing the lawns. I have to pay somebody to do this. All the time there is a work. All the time there is a work, people working for me, putting a door, repairing things. I do my thing. Like in before the pandemic, there would be an issue if there was a physical issue with our house. I always took care of this. So there wasn't this. And even if tenant had a temporary lost the job, I would understand. But is it never ending because there is a moratorium? And I talk to other landlords. They just don't see an end to it. They don't, like, our voice is not heard. I'm, like, lifelong Democrat. I believe in all the value that you believe. And I would like to be ever evicted or cause a pain to a tenant.
Okay.
But that's not the case. I'm talking about the issue. It's not, there is no place that you can speak with the tenant or who doesn't pay or bring it to another solution.
All right, Yardana, thank you very much. Xochitl, you want to follow up there? Go ahead.
No, I hear what you're saying. I do really appreciate your coming at it from a values-driven way. Ultimately, we want to ensure that New York becomes an eviction-free place. And I know that through both the eviction moratorium, through assistance that happened through the state, that there are some recourses for landlords in order to hold both interests of making sure that we end our eviction crisis and that working class, leaders who happen to make extra income through being landlords are not adversely impacted. But fundamentally, we have to address the root of the crisis, which is that too many of our neighbors are being thrown out. But I hear you. I urge you, to talk to your legislator and to look at some of the paperwork that applies to landlords in your situation. And as you said, legal aid is an excellent resource for that.
All right, let's take our only break of the hour. When we come back, we'll ask our guests what their other priorities are as they look at not only sort of statewide politics, but Working Families Party has been very active in taking a look at what's going on in the city of Rochester. January 22nd is a primary. It's a very important day. And the Working Families Party has weighed in there as well. So we're going to talk about what they see getting done on the state level. Some of the WFP-backed candidates who won last year, Sarah Clark, Damon Meeks, Harry Bronson, among others, have already been working on passing legislation and doing some work in Albany. And we're going to talk about that as well. So we're talking priorities with a political party that is often not running candidates on its own line only, but also sort of working within primary circles and has been pretty effective. So we're going to talk to Xochitl Nemeca, the director of the New York Working Families Party, Stevie Vargas, education organizer and chair of the Rochester chapter, and Emma Lee is a WFP chapter member. Let's take that break, and we're right back with them on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about a math equation that went viral last month. Just a grade-level equation that even math teachers around the world were split on how to get the best answer, how to get the right answer, the single answer. And if they couldn't agree, what chance do we non-math teachers have? What have we actually learned from math when we were growing up? What do we still use? What do we teach kids today? There will be math next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's talk about what else is on the priority list right now for the Working Families Party. Xochitl Nemeca, director. I'm going to ask all three of our guests about this. I'll start with Xochitl. What tops the list for what Working Families Party wants to see happen? Or if you want to highlight some of the things that are actually happening in Albany right now, given some of the changes in leadership there, I want to open the floor for that too. Go ahead, Xochitl.
Absolutely. I mean, we just have come off of a victory in probably the most progressive budget in New York State history, right? One that successfully raised revenue from the wealthiest in our state, right? We saw, as most of us were in the depths of the pandemic, that New York's, 116 billionaires actually saw their incomes and their assets soar, just further creating this crater we have of wealth and opportunity gaps in the state. And so we knew that if we want to get out of the decades of austerity and disinvestment that we saw from our schools that were shutting down or they're staying open, we had overcrowded classrooms with no nurses, no social workers. What we saw in the early days of the COVID pandemic, that schools in New York City were kept open primarily because that's where so many of our kids can count on getting a meal over the course of the day, right? So we're keeping schools open to address food insecurity in our communities. How we saw that our healthcare system and our hospitals were not prepared or resourced in a way to deal with this crisis. And so we had to invest in the common good. And what we saw this past year is that we're able to build real coalition support of elected officials and advocates pushing for real investment. Our Invest in Our New York campaign delivered this progressive revenue, right, as opposed to regressive revenue through sales taxes or, casino progressive revenue.
Hmm.
to invest in food, to invest in our social safety net. And that is the kind of progressive movement that we want to make. Focus on education equity, our foundation, ADAP, which I'm sure Stevie can even speak to way better than I can, right? We are fully funding our school after decades of balancing the budget on the backs of our children. And so one key priority was progressive revenue in order to invest in the common good. Another thing that we're lifting up is a decarceration platform, right? How are we addressing the crisis and the scourge of mass incarceration in our state through elder parole laws, through, you know, the end of solitary confinement use in New York State, through the decriminalization of cannabis in New York State, right? How do we rectify and undo the harm, the racialized harm, especially on Black and Brown New Yorkers, and really address our mass incarceration crisis? We continue to work on that. And we have to ensure full equitable COVID recovery from workers who were excluded from federal relief, right? We created a First in the Nation Excluded Workers Fund this year to gig workers who are improperly misclassified as contractors, and they fail to get any real benefits that they deserve as employees. We have to rebuild our social contract in the state, and that comes from ensuring that our policies and our platforms are rooted in equity and justice, that everyday people understand the role that politicians are playing in changing our lived experience and ensuring that our schools are funded, ensuring that we have safe, accessible transit, in addressing the climate crisis we're trying to do through the CCIA this year. There's a lot to win, and the progressive momentum is quite strong. Already, we're in May, we've decriminalized cannabis use, we've fully funded education, we created a excluded worker fund, we ended solitary confinement use in New York State. This is what progressive politics is about.
Yeah, I mean, I hesitate to use the binary question, you know, are you winning? I don't even, this isn't about winning or losing. This is about actually making real changes. But do you feel, Xochi, that for the first time in many years, the work that you wanted to see done is getting done in much more substantial fashion? Is that a fair way to put it?
Absolutely. I would say that we are ascendant, even as the crises facing our society are ever large, right? And so we're really addressing the role that government should play in delivering for working people, for marginalized communities, and we're making real victories, but we're also undoing harm, right? We need to get into a place where we can vision and build anew, and right now we are undoing harm, which is affecting people's lives in a positive way, but we want to get to that moment where we are rebuilding and reimagining. What does a full green social housing program look like across the state, right? What can our power support, our power supply come from? Can we be building windmills all over the state? We need to get into that posture of really governing fully with a progressive mindset, but we definitely are ascendant and we're bringing the people up with us.
Stevie Vargas, how do you see the question of not only priorities, but maybe how it applies right here in Rochester, given that there are elections coming?
Yeah, we've seen like a major shift in Rochester politics that I'm extremely excited about. We can look at previously the wins of Sommer Brooks, Amon Meeks, Jeremy Cooney, Sarah Clark, who had really progressive platforms, especially for the Rochester area. And we've seen them put that in action, especially during this last budget. Jen Lunsford, who actually won on the Working Families Party line, and Sarah Clark were huge child care advocates. We had Samra and Jeremy and Sarah really pushing for education in this budget, making sure that we got that foundation aid, because Rochester has been in a severe deficit when it came to our education. And our students have experienced horrific loss because of that. And then we have Demond Meeks and Samra Brook really working on what mental health looks like here, especially when police interact with those who have are in a mental health crisis. How creating legislation to make sure that police are not macing our children And we can see that that is what we want to see in our communities. We want to see electeds who are taking action and putting pen to paper, because policy is our love language, and we need our electeds to really look through policies and point out the inequities in those policies to make sure that we are having, that we have a safe community. And what we see with the Working Families Party as well is really working in community, working with families to redefine what safety for us looks like. And that means resources, mental health resources, resources for substance abuse, resources for healthcare, resources for education. And that was reflected in this state's budget that Working Family Party candidates really propelled. And that is what we want to continue to see. And that's what we're going to continue to do and work towards.
Emma, how do you see the list of priorities?
I'm really excited about a lot of the progress that has happened so far in Rochester, and I'm hopeful looking at the upcoming election. We have some really exciting candidates that we're hoping to see on city council. We endorsed Malik Evans for mayor, Jasmine Regler, who's wonderful housing advocate. She's endorsed for city council, as well as Stanley Martin and a number of other really wonderful folks. And as Stevie was saying, fully funding our vision towards reimagining what public safety looks like. Fully funding our police accountability board is a great start, making sure that we have the tools to really reshape public safety, to actually be keeping people safe. I find it completely absurd that our police force has made national news, international news even, several times in the past year for brutalizing our citizens, our community. I witnessed a mental health arrest happening 2 days ago, and I asked one of the officers where the PIC team was, the person in crisis team, which is one of the, you know, people that, one of the things that we're trying to bring into place to kind of safeguard people. And he said that they were busy, they were on another call. So I think we really need to look at expanding these services that we provide as a community for our members to keep everyone safe.
I want to just, if I could just expand on some of what Emma's saying there. I think it's really important, because when Emma talks about PIC, we talked about on the county levels, there's FIT teams, the forensic units that are much like PIC. They're there with police sometimes to kind of go into these situations instead of armed officers. And sometimes we talk about them abstractly, but we've had some really good reporting lately, including our colleague Gino Finelli at City News, who wrote along with PIC. And my takeaway from that, Emma, was these people are very good at what they do. They have a wonderful human touch. They have training that is probably different than what police officers get. And it was in some ways really beautiful to see how they solved some of these issues in sort of non-confrontational, very effective ways. But to your point, and this is what the chief of the Gates Police Department told us, the resources for all of these teams remains very limited. Despite what you may hear from leadership at the county or city levels, the police departments themselves are telling us, if we want more PIC or FIT, we got to spend a lot more. We're nowhere close to having the resources to get everybody there for every call that we would need. So all I'm pointing out here is what Emma is saying is backed up by the police themselves in terms of the actual resources. And we don't have to think about these teams abstractly. They are people. They're really good at what they do. It's really interesting to watch them work. And you ought to check out Gino's work in City News. Listeners, if you want to read more about that. Sorry, Emma, I just wanted to kind of add a little bit there, because I thought it was interesting that police themselves are sort of agreeing with that point. But go ahead.
Absolutely. And I appreciate all of that. I think that we really need to look at where we are spending our money. I'm so happy with our budget being passed in the state. But, you know, do we need more mounted patrol officers? You know, like, what purpose is that really serving? I know that there was just a new horse bought, and, you know, it seems like there's certain places where we are spending money. It's not necessarily, do we need the police force at the size that it is if we're actually investing into other first responders, community-based first responders? Maybe it's more of a reallocation of funds even.
Well, let me work through some more feedback from listeners. And these are self-identified progressives like Michael, who says, I want to ask the Working Families Party about letting criminals out of prison and how that makes us safer. There was no blue wave in 2020 because of defund the police. and the riots. Democrats lost seats in the House and only won the Senate because of Stacey Abrams. That is from Michael, a self-identified progressive in Rochester. Xochitl Nemeca, do you want to take that?
I think what we saw actually in New York State is that we did see a blue wave of seats, especially in the Western New York and Rochester region, being flipped from red to blue, and Democrats across the state who were in support of bail reform who held on to their seats. And so I do think there is a false narrative that Democrats have lost or need to be on their heels around compassionate and sensical, right, commonsensical approaches to decarceration, right? We know that we have a mass incarceration crisis in our society. We know that prison is not serving, right, a social good, and that having a compassionate release, having a plan for those who have served their time in prison and who should be reunited with their communities, especially in a pandemic where we saw the virus ravaging prisons, right, is the way we need to move forward as a just society. And so there were sensationalized cases last year as put forward by police unions and the right of the, you know, incident of harm or that may have been caused after release, right? That was a sensationalist narrative that was meant to undermine and discredit the position that Democrats had. But fundamentally, we did not take political hits over it. And we have to continue to push forward with this vision that we cannot address social crisis, social harm, social ills, disparity through a cruel, deeply racialized criminalization system that we have that is really a stain on our society and our country.
Stevie Vargas, I know you've been heavily involved in social justice movements here in Rochester, of course. Angela is a self-identified progressive who points me to the comments that Democratic Whip Jim Clyburn made. Of course, he's a black member of Congress who is from South Carolina, and he said in November that defund the police cost Democrats seats across the country, and it hurts the Black Lives Matter movement. What do you make of that, Stevie?
I think it just highlights that language is incredibly important in the way that we communicate. So defund is scary for a lot of people, especially people who are heavily reliant on police to solve community issues. To me, defund is the same as reallocating, and it's crucial into reimagining what public safety looks like. Because I also think it's unfair to make police officers solely responsible for those battling with substance abuse disorder, those experiencing mental health crises. They are not equipped to solve those systemic issues in our society. And it's a disservice to people who love the police force, who respect the police and want to uplift police officers in their community. I think it's a fundamental language shift that we need to talk about and do a lot of public education around what defund actually means. It means a lot of different things to a lot of different people, and it means something different to every community. That word is not a monolith, just like being a Democrat is not a monolith. There are layers to it. So here in Rochester, when we say defund, we're saying we want you to invest in education. We want you to invest in mental health resources. We want you to invest in things that police are responding to that they are not equipped to deal with. Take that burden off of them and really support people. And it's also about decriminalizing the language as well, not referring to people as criminals. Or we refer to people as formerly incarcerated because that does not define them. And we need to look at the data, recidivism rates, and all of those things. What are things that truly make the community safe? And how does defund play into that?
And Stevie, since we're going to lose the hour in about a minute here, I know that WFP is weighing in on the local elections. What do you want to leave with listeners as they seek to learn more before the June 22nd primary?
I ask people to engage in these very important conversations, engage with the candidates, see what they're about, see how they want to uplift the community and why WFP has endorsed these candidates, because it's incredibly important to have options, especially uplift candidates who are willing to work with the community. That's something that it's incredibly important and that the establishment has forgotten to do, their unwillingness to work with the community. So really make sure that you are taking the time to engage these candidates and work with them because they want to hear from you.
And I know, as you said earlier, you know, votes on Working Party Family Line matter. I mean, I'm not obviously as a journalist endorsing anything. It's interesting to me, though, parties have had to work very hard in this state, given the thresholds of viability to stay on ballot lines, to sort of keep organizing and fundraising. And so that will be interesting to see if people respond in that way. And you can see how fast the hour melts away. But I want to ask our guests if they'll come back and join us as we continue these conversations. So interesting. Stevie Vargas, thanks for making time for the program, as always. Emily, nice to have you. Yeah, thank you, Emma. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Evan.
And Xochi Nemeka, director of the New York Working Families Party. I know we'll talk again. Thank you, Xochi.
This is fantastic. Looking forward to it.
More connections coming up in a moment.